Bevor es losgeht mit dieser Episode, ein ganz wichtiger Hinweis. Schon sehr bald findet das AHA-Festival statt. Am 30. und 31. Januar, wie gewohnt, im Kulturzentrum Südpol in Luzern. Dieses Jahr geht's unter anderem um Fragen wie: Warum essen wir, was wir essen? Warum gibt es 380.000 Käferarten, aber nur eine Menschenart? Und warum wollen wir eigentlich eine Heimat? Das ganze Programm findet ihr in den Shownotes. Der Vorverkauf läuft schon sehr, sehr gut. Wer also unbedingt dabei sein möchte, geht lieber auf Nummer sicher und sichert sich das Ticket schon jetzt. Der Link zu den Tickets ist ebenfalls in den Shownotes. Wir freuen uns sehr, auch Podcast-HörerInnen am AHA zu sehen. Und jetzt geht's los mit der nächsten AHA-Episode über Zucker.
It's a history of capitalism. It is the history of how sugar formed capitalism, shaped capitalism, and how capitalism in turn shaped our sugar consumption. More and more people had to be put on the fields. Slavery continued to exist in Cuba and in Brazil until the very end of the 19th century. And this is a very interesting story because people who came from the countryside in Europe were not used to this kind of sugary food.
Was früher ein kostbarer Luxus war, ist längst zur alltäglichen Notwendigkeit geworden. Ulbe Bosma ist Autor von «The World of Sugar», einer Geschichte des Zuckers und des Zuckerhandels. Er hat untersucht, wie Zucker uns nicht nur körperlich, sondern auch gesellschaftlich in seinen Bann zieht. Sein Vortrag vom AHA-Festival im Januar 2025 erzählt von den ökonomischen und neutralen Realitäten, die unsere Sehnsucht nach Süßem nähren. Es ist die Geschichte einer Sucht, die wir gar nicht mehr bemerken. Viel Spaß mit dieser Lecture.
The question I was asked to address today is, how did we become addicted to sugar? Now, the word addicted is a little bit problematic in the case of sugar, because sugar is not as addictive as alcohol or nicotine or cocaine. But still, it is a bit addictive, doctors say. I'm not that much interested in the issue of addicted, but I'm particularly interested in the issue of the we. The fact that we consume so much sugar is a historical and societal phenomenon. It's a historical and societal responsibility. It's not an individual responsibility. The fact that so many of us are becoming obese, heavyweight, is not just an individual problem. So it's a societal problem. And I think also an issue which historians should address, and which I did. I wrote this book, The World of Sugar, which came out 1.5 years ago at Harvard University Press, a wonderful academic publisher, and has been translated now in 9 languages. So it's much more than just individual responsibilities. It's a history, it's a history of capitalism, it is the history of how sugar formed capitalism, shaped capitalism, and how capitalism in turn shaped our sugar consumption. So what is my book about, and what is my story about? It's about how we feed ourselves. Sugar has become such an important part of our daily diet. Go in your kitchen, look at the shelves, look at the packaged items, and you will see that in almost every packaged item there is sugar. So that's one point. The other point is a history of how we relate ourselves. And we can easily think about the history of slavery. Slavery has been part and parcel of the history of sugar. I will get back to that in a minute. And finally, it's a history about how we relate to nature. You see here a burning cane field in Florida. What happens is that just before the harvest, the mechanical harvest is entered the cane fields, the cane is set ablaze. And that's done to get the stalks rid of the leaves. It makes it easier to mow the cane. But of course, entire cities in Florida, and also, for example, in Brazil, are put under a thick layer of smoke, and people are almost suffocating. And the cane burning is just one of the environmental consequences of sugar production. Others are the use of extreme amounts of fertilizer, which pollutes the water, and of course, the problem of dehydration. Western India, it's a huge sugar belt there, really suffers from dehydration today. So, my argument is that our alarming sugar consumption of today is the result of how capitalism works, how our food industry works, rather than our craving for sweetness. And we cannot understand this work of capitalism, which I define as private enterprise for profit. We cannot understand this without the role of the state. And we'll get to the role of the state in many instances during my talk in the coming 40 minutes. It's also that if we take a global understanding of sugar, and sugar is really a global history, we also come to rethink the origins of capitalism. How did it start? Where did it start? Actually, sugar production started in Asia. And this is something not many people know, but until the 1870s, most of the world's sugar was produced in India and in China, and not in the Atlantic realm. People are inclined to think that most of it was produced in the Atlantic realm. It's produced in Asia. The largest sugar producer in the early 18th century was not Brazil or Jamaica, but was the tiny island of Taiwan. It was producing for the Chinese market. And here you see a Taiwanese sugar plantation with the mill in the center, with the boiling pots, with the people carrying cane to the mill. Actually, there was an exemption within within Asia. In Asia, most of the sugar was peasant sugar, and still is, by the way. Peasants have a plot of land where they have some cane. They have bring the mill to the field, or they bring the mill the cane to a mill in the village, and there they make some rather coarse raw sugar. And then refiners from the city come in and buy this coarse sugar, refine it, and then begin to trade with the sugar. And this happened from the 30th century onwards in Asia, first over land and increasingly also over sea. So by the 13th century, most of the sugar was exported by India, China, and Egypt. And sugar was indeed exported and traded in considerable quantities, but still it was a luxury. And particularly the white crystalline sugar was a luxury because it was very difficult to make. It took weeks to refine sugar that it delivered the nice crystals which we know today. But our sugar of today is industrially manufactured. Until the Industrial Revolution, white crystalline sugar was very precious and something only available for the very wealthy. For example, for the Caliph of Cairo, of Egypt, for the Mughal of India, the Emperor of India, or the Emperor of China. And what did these guys do with this? They made wonderful sculptures of sugar. Sugar is a great sculpting material. So they made sculptures, you can see it on the left. There's a table adorned with all kinds of sculptures made of sugar. In exact this case, this table is a European picture. The European princes began to emulate the Asian princes in the 15th century, making sugar sculptures. Over time, these sculptures became smaller. So they entered the households in Amsterdam, for example, in the 17th century, and it became smaller and smaller and smaller until we have our candies of today. The other application of this precious commodity, the sugar, was medicinal. In the second century after Christ, there was a very famous doctor, his name was Clodius Galenus, who held that the human health was dependent upon the balance of four bodily tempers, of humors. There was hot and cold and wet and dry. And when the balance was distorted, people got sick. And one of the means, he argued, to restore this balance within the human body was by adding some sugar. So sugar was considered to be a very important medicine. People also discovered in practice that it was a very healthy thing, because if people suffered from diarrhea and got weakened, and a little bit weakened, then if they got some sugar that was dissolved in water, got some sugar water, they really recovered a bit. And from this recovery, there emerged these sugary drinks with some flavor added to it. It was called the sherbets in Asia. Later on, with some ice, it became our sorbets. Again, a little bit later on, a few centuries later on, it was a pharmacist in the United States who also thought, well, we can make a wonderful medicinal drink which is good for people, and he called it Coca-Cola. So you see here that our beverage have their roots in medicine. So this is how it started. Over time, even in the Middle Ages, more and more sugar was produced, albeit that sugar continued to be very expensive until the Industrial Revolution. And it has everything to do with the fact that even though the milling, the grinding of the sugar improved technically, much of the whole process of boiling sugar, the cutting the cane in the field, bringing the sugar to the mills, was all manual work, very arduous work, and work that took a lot of people and a lot of time. But the basic format of these factories was such that the archaeologist who reconstructed a 14th century sugar mill in Cyprus, that for the reconstruction they used drawings from an 18th century Brazilian mill. So this is an indication how little and how slow technology developed over time. Meanwhile, Europe began to become accustomed to sugar. First of all, much of this sugar came from Egypt. It was brought by Genoese and Venetian traders. It were not just the princes and the aristocrats who consumed sugar, but also the bourgeoisie in the cities in Holland or in Switzerland, in southern Germany or in France, who became accustomed to bits of sugar. And precisely at that time, the sugar belt in Egypt collapsed. And the few sugar islands in the Mediterranean, Sicily, Cyprus, the southern coast of Spain, and a bit later on Madeira and the Canary Islands, could not fulfill the demand of Europe. So at the time that Europe began to love sugar, it could not produce it locally. Simply, Europe is too cold for producing cane sugar. So here this tremendous and horrific story of slavery started. And of the 12.5 million people who made the Middle Passage, who were kidnapped and deported from Africa to the Americas, almost two-thirds probably ended up at the sugar plantations. And one of the reasons is that sugar was an extremely important commodity. Another reason is that the conditions at these sugar plantations were absolutely horrendous. People went into the fields, cut in the cane without shoes, got terrible wounds. They had to bring dung into the fields in baskets, which they had to put on their heads. The working hours during the harvest were about 18 hours. People had to stay in these sugar mills, boiling the sugar juice at terribly high temperatures. And then you had around these plantations many wars, cyclones, and famines. And meanwhile, sugar consumption in Europe grew and grew and grew, and more sugar was demanded, and more people had to be enslaved and brought to the Americas. Now, you may wonder whether this story is just one without resistance. No, there was resistance from the very beginning. Enslaved people resisted from the very beginning, from the 16th century, until in 1791, there was one very successful rebellion in the French sugar islands, sugar, coffee, and indigo islands, Saint-Domingue, which later became Haiti. The news about all these rebellions, about what was going on there in the plantations, but also about the horrific conditions on these plantations, also reached Europe, and particularly Britain. And there, consumers in the early 19th century started to reject sugar that was made by enslaved workers. And they called it is sugar that is stained with the spots of human blood. Kind of cannibalistic connotation. And they said it's not necessary to consume this sugar. Why not are we consuming sugar from India? Because India is what was at that time the largest sugar producer in the world. And they did so. So many households in Britain in the early 19th century, they served sugar that was made in India in wonderful sugar bowls. This is a particularly wonderful one. It says, East India sugar not made by slaves. And this refusal to consume sugar that was made by enslaved labor is actually the first fair trade movement in the world. Meanwhile, others were looking for alternatives for cane to make sugar from. So people tried maple, and maple syrup is still existing today in the United States and in Canada. It's very popular there. In France, people tried to make sugar from grapes. So others tried to make sugar from potatoes, which was not very successful. And then there was the ugly beet, Rüben auf Deutsch. There was a particularly a pharmacist in Germany in the mid-18th century, who discovered that these ugly beets contained significant amounts of sucrose. And he had an apprentice, a pupil. His name was Franz Karl Aschar. And he was a good inventor, a real inventor. He let up an air balloon above Berlin, for example. And he started to discover how sugar could be made from these beetroots at an industrial scale. Well, yeah, industrial, this is his first factory, which you can see here on the right. It's not very impressive. But people from entire Europe came to his factory, his small factory, to learn how to make sucrose from beetroots. And Franz Karl Aschar wrote a wonderful manual on how to fabricate this sugar. At the end, he ended his manual with exclaiming that my invention can end slavery for sugar. There was another guy who was very happy with Aschar's invention, and his name was Napoleon. Napoleon had imposed the continental system in 1806 in Europe, and that meant that no goods from Britain could enter continental Europe. And precisely at that time, in 1806, Britain had conquered most of the sugar colonies that existed in the world, including those of the French. So no sugar came in Europe. And people started to complain, because meanwhile in the cities, even simple people had some sugar in the morning in their coffee or in their tea. So people were dissatisfied with the situation. And now Karl Aschar came with his invention, and Napoleon said, let's do it. We get sugar, beet sugar, that will the sugar be the sugar of the future. And he agreed that it was good not longer to have any colonies. He sold, for example, the colony, French colony of Louisiana, to the Americans. Napoleon didn't like colonies. He liked to be a landlocked empire in Europe. So beet sugar was introduced as anti-colonial sugar. But there was one big problem with beet sugar, and that problem exists even today, and that is that it is more expensive than cane sugar to make. And yet the world was flooded with beet sugar by the end of the 19th century. And here we begin to see the first parts of the answer why we are consuming so much sugar today, because that is of the success of the beet sugar production. But first of all, I have to go one step back. Why did sugar become, and sugar production become, so popular in Europe? Now, one part of the explanation is that the production of sugar is extremely labor intensive. It requires a lot of labor. Not in a factory. The factories modernized very, very rapidly after the Industrial Revolution. No, it was the work in the field. Because mechanical cane harvesters and wheat harvesters only entered the field after the Second World War. And until then, because the demand soared in the 19th century, it grew very rapidly, more and more people had to be put on the fields. Slavery continued to exist in Cuba and in Brazil until the very end of the 19th century. And this is the explanation. It has everything to do with the many hands that were needed to grow the cane. And the same goes for beet, by the way. So, precisely this labor intensity explains why the beet sugar industry in Europe could become so big, and why we are consuming so much sugar. What happened about 1870 is that new ways to produce steel brought about steel ships, big steel ships, that could carry wheat from the New World, from the Americas, to Europe, and at a relatively cheap price, cheaper than much of the wheat could be produced in Europe. And this is one of the reasons why an agrarian depression scorched Europe from the 1870s onwards, because the huge imports of wheat put many wheat farmers in Europe out of employment. Now, at exactly that point, the sugar beet offered relief, precisely because it gave employment to so many people. So many people came from Poland to Prussia, for example, or from Flanders to France. So millions of people, agricultural laborers, found employment, at least seasonal employment, in the beet sugar industry. And precisely at that time that the European rural population started to grow quite rapidly because of the decline of infant mortality. And because it became such an important sector within the European agrarian economy, European governments started to protect the beet sugar industry, even though there was, from the 1870s onward, a clear overproduction of sugar in the world. So what these governments did, they put a taxation on sugar at the factory gate, but for all the sugar that these factories exported, they got a rebate. So they got the money back, but they got more than the money back. In fact, what the European governments did, the Prussian government, the French government, or the government of Austria-Hungary, was they subsidized the exports of sugar. The result was that a family in Britain got its sugar much cheaper on its table, its kitchen table, than, for example, a family in Prussia, or a family in Denmark got its sugar much cheaper than the family in the Netherlands. So what we see is that in Great Britain, sugar consumption began to soar, grew very rapidly. Here we see already why Britain became addicted to sugar. Now, this dumping practice was not something the British looked upon favorably. They didn't like the idea of dumping. They thought it gave all kinds of economic distortions. And it became particularly annoyed when big steel ships filled with beet sugar left the harbor of Trieste in the Mediterranean Sea to go across the Suez Canal and called the port of Bombay. So they unloaded beet sugar in Bombay in India, which is kind of carrying cokes to Newcastle. And the British government said, well, this is a very dangerous thing, because if cheap beet sugar floods the Indian market, it will cause all kinds of problems on the Indian countryside, because for the Indian farmers, for Indian peasants, sugar production is part of their livelihood. And if that's endangered, it may create all kinds of unrest in India. So that may directly jeopardize the English rule over India. So they called the European sugar producers in Brussels and said, now we have to stop this whole dumping process. They did. They put a brake on the dumping, and dumping was drastically reduced. Beet sugar, which was made up still 60% of the world market in 1900, only made up 40% of the world market in a few years later. So it was really successful policies against dumping. Within Europe, and continental Europe, and it includes Switzerland, it includes Austria-Hungary, France, Germany, the Netherlands, the factories got in trouble, of course, because now sugar prices in the European continent declined, profits declined. Declining profits is something universal within the sugar industry over the past 1.5 centuries, but particularly in the 20th century. So sugar producers responded to this decline in declining profits by concentration, by forming cartels. And it had two effects. With the cartels, they were able to set the prices for the suppliers of the raw material, in this case, the beets. So the beet farmers were confronted with declining prices for their beets. The other side of the cartel is that they could control the retail prices. So this is how food industry works. They tried to form cartels to both control the supply of the raw materials as well as the retail market. The beet sugar farmers responded to this cartelization by building their own factories. They did it, for example, in the Netherlands, where we have only, at this stage, only one sugar factory, a sugar industry, which is called the Cooperative Sugar Producers Union, the COSUN. And in France and Germany, similar tendencies were there. In Switzerland, we have a kind of mixed model. At least the beet farmers try to control the industrial side to prevent that the prices for their wheat would further decline. Declining prices because of overproduction in the world continued throughout the 20th century, and particularly in the 1920s. At that time, the European wheat sugar producers, the industrialists, decided to unionize at a European level, which was quite unique. We haven't seen that before, that European agrarian producers unite at the European level. So in 1927, they established the Confédération Internationale de Betteraviers Européens, and the idea was to join forces in the League of Nations, which has an economic committee that tried to organize the global commodity market, because the sugar was not the only commodity suffering from overproduction. Now, it becomes very interesting, because after the Second World War, a number of European countries established the European Economic Union, and thus developed the so-called agricultural policies, which are still in place today. And the idea was that Europe had to recover from the Second World War, that the industry had to be built up, so wages had to be mitigated, had to be low, but at the same time, people had to be sure that there was sufficient food supplied. So the best way to do that was to provide the farmers with a guaranteed price at which they could produce their food, and to have mitigated and guaranteed prices for the consumers. So they would create rest in the food market. But of course, this could only be made possible through a generous subsidy system. So this whole agricultural policies is also a subsidized food production system. Now, this was again done in such a generous way that even though there was, in theory, there was a ceiling put on the guaranteed prices for sugar, in practice, the ceiling was so high that the sugar factories continued to produce much more than the ceiling, and the rest, which remained was above the ceiling, was dumped on the world market. The same process as in the late 19th century. So this had a severe effect on the sugar prices beyond the European Union. This was only gradually abolished after the verdict of the World Trade Organization, after other sugar producers, Australia, Thailand and Brazil, had litigated at the World Trade Organization. European Union, I have to say, the European Union was forced to abandon its dumping practices, like European countries had been forced to do that one century earlier. It has led to restructuring of European sugar production. And all over Europe, beet farmers are suffering because prices are declining and European sugar factories had to be restructured. The big sugar companies, the transnational corporations, do not suffer. They were heavily subsidized by Brussels to make a transition possible, to find a way to produce sugar elsewhere in the world, for example, in Southern Africa and in Brazil, where they're now encroaching upon the Amazon region. This is all creating overproduction, and with a heavy hand of the government. Now, I've talked about Europe. The situation in the United States is slightly different, but has some important similarities. It's slightly different because in the United States, it had also cane sugar producers directly in its orbit. In 1898, it annexed Hawaii, which was a very important sugar producer. It conquered Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines from Spain in 1898. And all of a sudden, it had a wonderful sugar empire and was self-sufficient. And what also happened is that American banks, American financial circles began to invest heavily in sugar production in Cuba. So it was impossible for the American government to choose the sides of the beet sugar producers, of domestic beet sugar producers. They had to calibrate the whole system. And what they did, and they did it in 1934 under the Roosevelt administration, is to install a quota system, which each of the stakeholders got quota, as long as they behaved. because when in 1959 Cuba had the revolution under Fidel Castro and nationalized all the sugar industries, including the capital, which was invested by the Americans, of course the sugar quota were withdrawn and were given to the Philippines and to the Dominican Republic, where at that time nasty dictators had their regimes. Even quite recently, a regime was punished by withdrawing quota. It was the regime of the government of Nicaragua, where the leftist Sandinistas were in power, and their sugar quota were withdrawn by Ronald Reagan. So you see, there's a lot of geopolitics in here, a lot of politics, and there's nothing here as what we would call a free market. Now, I've talked about the role of the governments, about the development of capitalism, how this engendered overproduction and kept overproduction in place. But of course, you also want to know about the consumers. And this is a very interesting story, because people who came from the countryside in Europe were not used to this kind of sugary food. Their food was much more, had different taste. So when French rural migrants came to Paris, they found this sugary food quite effeminate, didn't like it at all. So people had to get used to higher intakes of sugar. And they did that by sheer propaganda. So we have here this postcard. I don't think I need to translate it here. And it was also, sugar was put in the rations of soldiers. And they discovered, the authorities of the army, that it enhanced the endurance of these soldiers. So there was a kind of eureka moment. So sugar was good. And it was also considered good by medical doctors, by employers, and by governments. Because in the late 19th and early 20th century, many people moved from the countryside into the cities and were often malnourished. They were malnourished in many ways, proteins, vitamins, but that was not something employers were very concerned about. They were also undernourished in terms of calories. So sugar, around the turn of the century, the 20th century, was considered a healthy part of your diet. Now, was that true? Were there no signs of protest? Well, for the middle classes, particularly the middle class and the higher classes in Britain, where food was plentiful. And there was one undertaker, his name was William Banting, he was a high-end undertaker who also buried members of the royal house, and he got really fat, and so fat that the doctors told him, well, if you continue this way, you will become the customer of your own enterprise. So stop this. And so he stopped consuming carbohydrates, not just sugar, but also other carbohydrates. And he wrote a letter on that, how he got his original weight back. And that is a letter, it's called A Letter on Corpulence, which was published in 1863 and was quite popular over the course of the 19th century among the middle classes. In some countries in Europe even, doing Banting is still synonymous with being on diet. Of course, this was just the middle classes and the higher classes. For the proletariats, sugar was still considered to be an energy giver in the early 20th century. And sugar became more and more important in our diets, because when many people moved from the countryside to the city, they also lost their own yards, they lost their own gardens, where they grew their own food. So they came in the cities and they had to go to the markets, where food was often adulterated or even bad. It was could even be spoiled. The food industry that emerged at that time saw a wonderful opportunity, because if you have packaged food coming from a factory, people will recognize it as from a certain quality, even though the quality is not that good, because much of this packaged food is devoid of any fibers, because if you leave fibers in food, you can't keep it on the shelves for a long time. So the fibers got out, the sugar got in. That's the remedy, that's the principle of much of this packaged food from the early 20th century onwards. So Banting's lessons were also not followed, because in the 20th century, and we have the sweet beverages, we have the ice creams, we have the candies, etc., that emerge on an ever larger scale. Also, they are can produced on an industrial scale. And a bit later, we have the vending machines coming in. Now, another reason why the sugar industry was so successful in avoiding criticism about obesity, about the dental problems, is that in the 1950s, when indeed the people got increasingly aware of the fact that sugar makes fat, that the sugar industry began to start all kinds of research projects that took fat as the bad guy in the class and not sugar. So the attention was deflected from sugar to fat. And there was even research done by the Harvard University that was sponsored by the sugar industry, but without mentioning it in the article. So there was a kind of corruption. The reason why, and even though we know today, most of us know, that that this cheap, sweet and fat food is not good for you, that it's still so omnipresent, is that it is much cheaper, of course, than fresh and good and healthy food. Consumption increased and increased. And in this, in consumption patterns, all kinds of delights came in because we got richer and richer and we were able to consume goods on a daily basis, which in the past had been something, delights that could only be produced in a weekend or so. So we have here the beverages. The usual beverages are consist for 10% of sugar. An ice cream for 20 to 25% of sugar. Candies, 20 to 40%. Cookies, the same thing. Then we have this grizzly, which is so-called so healthy, it's not healthy. It's terrible. More than 50% usually. So you might ask the question, how is the situation in Switzerland? Consumption is almost twice as high. And what I read is that fingers are pointed at the famous Swiss sweetener industry. So all the chocolates, all the stuff which is produced here in Switzerland. So even the Swiss authorities and medical authorities get somewhat concerned about Swiss sugar consumption. I will get back to Swiss sugar consumption in a minute. First, the situation in the United States. Here, a new invention was applied. That was done in the 1970s. It was a kind of alteration of glucose that was produced by corn, by maize. It's called high fructose corn syrup. It's much sweeter than sugar. It's much cheaper and can be put in almost everything. And that's all done. So the obesity disaster we're now facing in the United States, the high fructose corn syrup is to a certain extent responsible for that. And some say that it is also more detrimental to your health. It might even be more addictive than sugar. This graph is a caveat here, a disclaimer. This is about sugar supplies, which I have tried to translate as sugar consumption. So there's a kind of disclaimer here. But the trends are very, very clear, I think. So our high sugar consumption is something which emerged after the Industrial Revolution, in the course of the Industrial Revolution, when it was possible to produce sugar at tremendous quantities, which was not possible before the Industrial Revolution. There was a demand side. That demand side was also encouraged by governments, by medics. The demand side was also encouraged because to help the sugar industry out because there was so much overproduction. What we can see is that the green line is Switzerland, that Swiss sugar consumption is declining a bit over the past years, but it's still much too high. The guideline of the World Health Organization is about 20 kilograms of sugar per capita per year. So Switzerland's almost double. United States, almost triple. And there's a lot of talk about a healthy Mediterranean diet, in Spain and Italy and Greece, but for all these countries we see that they're also moving towards the dangerous 30, 40 kilos per year. And the explanation is quite simple, because sugar is everywhere. Go in the supermarket, you see sugary stuff everywhere. You see the candies exactly at the height of a children's eye. That's how it works. It's really perverse. But it is also very dangerous, of course. Not for nothing, we now see that in most European countries, 50% or more of the adults is overweight, and 15 to 20% is really obese. So, what's the situation in Switzerland? Any idea? Switzerland is a bit better. The women are doing fine. That, well, fine. 30% is overweight or obese, but the men are over 50%. There's a huge gender disparity here. To conclude, how did we become addicted? I said, well, it's how the capitalists shaped the sugar industry. I also said that our sugar consumption is a recent phenomenon. And that is also a danger, because we have not yet learned how to deal with sugar consumption. It's relatively novel. It's like social media. We have not yet learned how to deal with it. So children are sitting on social media for 4 or 5 hours per day. So this is, I think, a similar mechanism. Governments have played a crucial role in this overconsumption. I'm a very strong proponent of applying sugar taxes to diminish sugar consumption. People say, yeah, that's a kind of interference of the government and free choice of people. Come on, there's never been free choice. The government has been there and has manipulating markets over hundreds of years. Come on, the government has a responsibility here. And you see, the paradoxical, to put it mildly, situation that on the one hand, governments in Europe feel compelled to support an ailing beet sugar industry, and on the other hand, they are concerned about the health effects of sugar. And society at large has to foot the bills of increasing health care costs, because we're really facing a obesity and diabetes type 2 pandemic. I thank you for your attention.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijašević. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.